It's now 8:45 Central African time, and we're joined by Advocate Shabnam Mayed, who is the coordinator of Protect the Rohingya. And as we heard from our previous guest, it is from her honorable offices that we've had the Black for Rohingya campaign starting a number of years ago, and just growing in strength. We highlight this campaign each and every year, and we're just more than pleased to see how it has taken off, and this time even within Myanmar, within the Arakan state, as we'll find out from her in a moment. Let's welcome her to the show once again. Shukran for your time, Shabnam. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Walaikum salam. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
It might be ad nauseum for some, but I always like to start off in this way, first and foremost, as far as why do we advocate for the Rohingya in a nutshell?
We advocate for the Rohingya because they're considered one of the world's most persecuted minorities. And if we look at how they've been treated, you know, they've been all the apartheid-like laws, the institutionalized racist laws that have been applied against them. They can't own land. They require government permission to marry. They're subject to forced sterilization where they have to sign a document saying how many children they can have. They don't have freedom of movement. They're not allowed access to education and tertiary education. And all of this has been happening since the late 70s. More recently, since the genocide in 2017, 1 million Rohingya were forced to flee across the border to Bangladesh, and around 300 Rohingya villages were totally destroyed. And we're speaking about villages with 600-year-old masajid, with schools, with madrasas, with history, with folklore, you know, with very interesting people and personalities that live there. And it's basically the erasure of an entire culture, an entire history. And so it's very important that we raise their voices and we assist them to raise their voices.
And there are many solidarity campaigns and movements around the world. Protect the Rohingya is the one you have spearheaded in South Africa, and born out from there has now come this global campaign. It's grown to become global, and obviously the power of you know, popular media out there has amplified this voice. Black for Rohingya, the roots of that, and how it has evolved over the years to this point.
Alhamdulillah, we can only say alhamdulillah actually about the campaign today. In 2013, we thought we're such a small organization, we don't really know about the Rohingya, we're still learning, it's only been a year. If we don't know, other people out there don't know, and we don't really have any money or funding, so why don't we think of a way where people can get involved that's not going to cost them anything, it's not going to cost us anything, and it's going to have some reach. And so we sat down and we brainstormed, and we came up with the idea of Black for Rohingya, where we ask people to please wear black on June 13 and to send a message of solidarity and their photo over social media. Now, the reason why it began in 2013 was because 2012 marked the massacres in Arakan of Rohingya. And that was the first time I think the international community started to see the Rohingya in the news. And we thought, okay, well, we don't know about them. Here's this group of people. They're Muslim. They're so far away. We don't even know their name, you know. And if that's the case, I'm sure a lot of other people out there would want to know them about them as well. And that's literally how the campaign began.
And as it stands this year, I mean, last year there was a particular focus on the internet ban in the camps. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's one issue from amongst a number of issues that can be highlighted, and perhaps everybody can spearhead a particular element of the struggle as part of dealing with the root causes of the struggle this mm-hmm. year. Has there been any particular element from the wide range of oppression that you've chosen to highlight above others?
So last year we went for the internet ban because, you know, internet is almost like a basic human right now. And the fact that the Rohingya were stuck in the camps without internet, that meant no access to information about COVID, not being able to be in touch with their families, not being able to receive money from overseas. We thought that was very important. This year, however, because of the military coup in Myanmar, we wanted to do a general campaign because, as you saw, as the year has progressed, people in Myanmar, after the 33rd Infantry Light Division, were called out to quell peaceful protesters, and ordinary Myanmar citizens were subject to the atrocities and the brutality of the Myanmar military, we started to see this slow kind of messaging coming out from a few people and activists and artists saying, we didn't know about the Rohingya, we were brainwashed, we were sorry, you know, we didn't understand what was happening. And once that same brutality was unleashed on the civilian population, they started to think about the Rohingya. And so we wanted to add to that voice. And so we kept it very general because we also wanted in this coup for people to remember that the Rohingya had suffered a genocide, and those 600,000 plus Rohingya who are still stuck in Rakhine State are still suffering. And that's why it's been very general. There's also a petition on the website, protecttherohingya.org, which asks that the UN, impose the arms embargo, sanction military companies and the military, protect the people, civilians of Myanmar, provide humanitarian aid. So we were keeping it very general because we were looking for wide participation.
This is so gratifying and so amazing, that the fact that something that, as you mentioned earlier, with extreme gratitude to the Almighty, something that was conceived perhaps as an idea in South Africa, actually found resonance today on the streets of Rohingya, if I'm reading reports correctly, that were shared earlier of how people were actually wearing black and protesting today within the Arakan state or within Myanmar, in a wider sense.
So in little towns and in Yangon and all around Myanmar, it's also a protest day, the revolution. People added Black for Rohingya to their protest. They also used the hashtag by this morning when we woke up, because of course in South Africa we're quite a bit ahead, behind. There were already around 180,000 tweets. And then of course it's climbed up to around just under 500,000. And it's just been amazing to see people in the streets of Myanmar. So the campaign didn't just stay on social media, but also people coming out and saying, we support the Rohingya, because you must remember, this is a country where they said the Rohingya don't even exist. They didn't even allow, right-wing extremist monks, didn't even allow foreign dignitaries to say the word Rohingya. They abused the UN special rapporteur, and they didn't even want to recognize. They kept saying that these are illegal Bengalis. And so the fact that the word Rohingya itself is being said in the streets of Myanmar this year, that in itself is a victory.
It reminds us of what we saw recently when it comes to the Palestinian struggle, and how, you know, after many years, and that's, you know, way more years if we have to look at the timeline there of oppression, and we always, you know, spoke about the grave sense of injustice and the victimhood, a media that was very much tied up with the discourse of oppression, and how we saw major shifts that have occurred in the last few months. And I want to concentrate on something that you shared a while back from Natalie Brigham, who wrote about the importance of language in how we speak about the Rohingya. So in these few minutes, I just want to touch on a few phrases, and perhaps you could just expound on those phrases. Why do we use this and not that? For example, when we spoke about Palestine, people would say you cannot use the word conflict, because there's no two equal sides, and you can't talk about both sides being oppressed, because one is the oppressor and one is the oppressed, and so forth. A process of correction, assertive correction, is happening there, and this should happen in all similar situations around the world. So, firstly, this particular post, for instance, says, don't use the term, or don't just use the term ethnic cleansing, rather use genocide. Tell us about that.
Well, ethnic cleansing was actually used, created as a term during Bosnia, right? But in terms of international law, it doesn't really have the force of genocide. And when we look at the requirements for genocide and the destruction of a part or whole group, I mean, everything that's happening to the Rohingya fits into that definition. But of course, if we had to say genocide, it would mean that the international community, because genocide, war crimes, apartheid, crimes against humanity are such grave crimes that they're literally crimes against all of humanity and require special focus and special attention and special responses, and certain duties would then kick in when it comes to the UN and member countries. And so it's easy to say ethnic cleansing, you know, we all know it means something bad, but what are the repercussions? They're definitely not the same as the repercussions for genocide.
Our previous guest, part of a Rohingya solidarity campaign, member of the Rohingya nation himself, talking to us about how he's stateless. But in the wider sense, we probably need to locate how did that statelessness happen. And this particular post says, do not just call the Rohingya stateless without first calling them Arakanese. Why is that so important?
Well, because Rohingya are not stateless. They have a state. They've been in that land for more than 800 years. Just because racist apartheid laws declared that, you know, the citizenship law of 1982 revoked their citizenship, that didn't make them stateless. It just made it an apartheid law that was imposed against them. But they've always had that state. They've always been in Arakan state. And they have a history, a culture, a language, a memory that is linked to Arakan state. And travelers long before knew that they were there. They were Muslim kingdoms, and they were Buddhist kingdoms, and they've always had that footprint there. So they're not stateless. Just because you revoke their citizenship, that doesn't mean that they were not there.
Also, when we talk about the military, when we talk about civilian rulership in Myanmar, that obviously has been tested at the moment. There's talk then of democratic elections. But, you know, an election, I guess, we cannot be democratic if there are people who are totally excluded from the process altogether. So why then, or just explain to us the caution then we should be exercising when talking about the onset of democracy in Myanmar or prospects for democracy in Myanmar, when, you know, we realize it's happening in a very limited sense.
So the first thing is, you know, a lot of people at the start of this coup called for a return to the rule of law. And the problem with that is that the rule of law was the 2008 military constitution, which gave 25% of the seats in parliament to the military, as well as retained many other problematic laws, right? The other thing, of course, is that when we're looking at it, the parliament that wasn't allowed to sit, those that were arrested and others that went into hiding during the coup, they have now come together with ethnic minorities to form the National Unity Government. There isn't Rohingya representation there because these were made, this group is ousted MPs, basically, right? But last week, they put out a statement stating that they would look for the repeal of that citizenship law, and citizenship should be based on being born in Myanmar or being born elsewhere to Myanmar parents. And then they also said that they would support the process at the international court, and they called on Rohingya to come and join the struggle. So it remains to be seen how it will roll out in future days, but Rohingya leaders have been in talks with ministers of this new government, and we'll have to see how that works out in coming days.
A last one for you would be, as far as this entire struggle, your involvement over these periods of years, and obviously looking and studying this decades-long struggle of the Rohingya people, what is it in the Rohingya people that gives you strength? What is it in the Rohingya people that inspires you in their attitude to all that has occurred to them over these years?
I have never seen such sincere faith as I have in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. I was very fortunate to be part of a legal team, an all-women's legal team, in December of 2017, just 3 months after the genocide, which went and then took witness statements to be made available to legal teams around the world who wanted to work, bring cases in their jurisdictions for the Rohingya. And so we sat down with over 60 victims and we took their stories. And people had said the most horrific things, like women who had been gang raped in their own homes, and when their children called out for them, their children were slaughtered, or men who watched their homes being burnt and their children being thrown into fires, and people who had been forced to walk for days through the jungle to make it to, you know, to the water so that they could take boats across to Bangladesh, women who were forced to run while they were pregnant and then stop to give birth and cut the umbilical cords of their children with their own teeth. But they crossed. They came to Bangladesh with nothing, and they created this life for themselves. It's not the best life. It's a life that we should all feel duty-bound to improve for them. But there they are, accepting what has happened to them with their faith. I mean, they have extremely beautiful faith. You know, they're very serious about their faith, but continuing, creating hope, creating informal schools in those refugee camps, safe spaces for women in those refugee camps, and finding a way to continue their lives and the lives of their children, and to remember who they are and to continue to stand up for who they are, for what their history is, and not to just disappear the way the Myanmar military wanted them to. And I think that is something that we can all respect and we can all, you know, feel duty bound to assist with.
Indeed, and this is an excellent opportunity to dig deeper, find out more, and renew our sense of commitment for justice for the Rohingya. Check out at Protect the Rohingya on Twitter, or you can follow the hashtag that's all over social media today, even within Myanmar, which is hashtag Black for Rohingya. Thank you so much for your time, and all the best for the remainder of today's campaign and the ongoing solidarity movement. Shukran for your time, Sharman. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you very much.